In the year 1872, number 7 Savile Row was occupied by Phileas Fogg, Esquire, an enigmatic figure about whom nothing was known, except that he was a thorough gentleman and one of the most handsome figures in high society. Mr. Fogg had never been spotted in the Stock Exchange, the bank, or the city. He was not on any board of directors. He was not engaged in industry, business, commerce, or agriculture. Phileas Fogg belonged to the Reform Club, and that was all. Should anyone express surprise that such a mysterious gentleman be numbered amongst the members of that distinguished society, it can be pointed out here that he was accepted on the recommendation of Messrs. Baring Brothers, with whom he had an unlimited overdraft facility. His cheques were always paid on sight, and his account remained invariably in the black. Those who had the honour of knowing him a little better than most attested that, apart from the very short route he took each day from his house to the club, nobody could claim ever to have seen him anywhere else. His only pastimes were reading the newspapers and playing whist. Although not palatial, the house in Savile Row was remarkable for its level of comfort. Because of the regular habits of its occupant, its management was far from onerous. Nevertheless, Phileas Fogg demanded an extraordinary punctuality and reliability from his one servant. That very day, the 2nd of October, he had given notice to James Forster. The fellow had made the mistake of bringing in his shaving water at a temperature of 84 degrees Fahrenheit, rather than the statutory 86. Mr. Fogg was even now expecting his successor, due to report between 11 and 11:30. Phileas Fogg sat in his armchair, watching the hand moving on the clock. A complicated apparatus that showed the hours, minutes, seconds, days, dates, and years. In keeping with his daily habit, Mr. Fogg was due to go to the Reform Club on the stroke of 11:30. A knock on the door of the morning room. James Forster, the sacked servant, appeared. "The new valet," he announced. A man of about 30 came in and bowed. "You are French and called John?"
"Jean, if sir pleases. Jean Passepartout, a nickname that was first applied due to my natural ability to get out of scrapes. I consider myself an honest fellow, sir, and I've had several occupations. I used to be a wandering singer and a circus rider. I was a trapeze artist and a tightrope walker. Then I became a gymnastics instructor. And lastly, I was a sergeant in the Paris Fire Brigade. I have some remarkable fires in my curriculum vitae. But I left France 5 years ago. Wishing to try domestic life, I became a personal manservant in England. Then, finding myself without a job, I heard that Mr. Phileas Fogg was the most stay-at-home man in the whole of the United Kingdom. I presented myself at Sir's house in the hope of being able to live in peace and forget the very name of Passepartout."
"Passepartout suits me very well," said Mr. Fogg, "and I have excellent references on your account. Are you aware of my terms?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very well, then. What time do you make it?"
11:22,
replied Passepartout, pulling an enormous silver watch from his waistcoat pocket. "Your watch is slow."
"Pardon me, sir, but that's impossible."
"You're 4 minutes slow. It is of no consequence. What matters is to note the difference. So, starting from this moment, 11:29 a.m. on Wednesday, the 2nd of October, 1872, you are in my employ." Whereupon Phileas Fogg got up and vanished. During the short time of his interview, Passepartout had been examining his new master. He was about 40 years old, with a fine and noble face, tall, and none the worse for a slight tendency to stoutness. He had fair hair and sideboards, a smooth forehead, a complexion that was pale rather than florid, and splendid teeth. This man seemed to possess to an exceptional degree what the physiognomists call repose in action, a quality of all those who produce more light than heat. Calm, phlegmatic, With clear eyes and a steady gaze, he was a consummate example of those self-possessed people encountered quite frequently in Britain. As for Passepartout, he had unruly brown hair, blue eyes, a ruddy complexion, and slightly sticking-out lips. He possessed a broad chest, a large frame, vigorous muscles, and Herculean strength. Passepartout found his bedroom on the second floor. He spotted a card displayed above the clock. It was the schedule of his daily duties. From 8 in the morning until midnight, when the methodical Mr. Fogg went to bed, everything was noted, planned, regulated. Passepartout took great pleasure in contemplating this schedule and committing its various entries to memory. "Just what I need," he murmured. "A home-loving and regular man. We'll get on famously, Mr. Fogg and me." Phileas Fogg's lunch consisted of an hors d'oeuvre of steamed fish in a Reading sauce of the highest quality, scarlet roast beef with mushrooms, rhubarb and gooseberry tart, and some Cheshire cheese, all washed down with a few cups of that excellent tea specially grown for the Reform Club. At 12:47, he moved into the drawing room. Reading the Times occupied him until 3:45, and the Standard until dinner. Half an hour later, various members of the club made their entrance and headed for the hearth, where a good coal fire was burning. These were Mr. Phileas Fogg's usual partners, like him, fanatical whist players. The engineer, Andrew Stewart. The bankers, John Sullivan and Samuel Fallentin. The brewer, Thomas Flanagan. And Gautier Ralph, one of the governors of the Bank of England.
"Well, Ralph," said Flanagan, "what's the latest news on this robbery?"
"The bank won't see its money again," volunteered Stewart.
"I am confident, on the contrary, that we will soon be able to lay our hands on the thief," maintained Gautier Ralph.
"Do we have the thief's description?" asked Stewart.
"The Morning Chronicle assures us that he is a gentleman."
The speaker was none other than Phileas Fogg, whose head now emerged from the sea of papers piled up around him. The robbery in question had taken place 3 days previously, on the 29th of September. A wad of notes amounting to the enormous sum of £55,000 had been taken from the desk of the chief cashier of the Bank of England. To those who expressed surprise that such a theft could be carried out so easily, Assistant Governor Gautier Ralph had merely replied that the cashier was at that time occupied recording a receipt of 3 and 6 pence, and that one cannot keep one's eyes on everything. Once the theft had thus been properly recorded, detectives were sent to the main ports of Liverpool, Glasgow, Le Havre, Suez, Brindisi, New York, etc. They had been promised a reward of £2,000 plus 5% of the sum recovered. The job of the detectives was to carefully observe everyone entering and leaving the country. Now, as the Morning Chronicle had pointed out, there was good reason to believe that the thief did not belong to any of the known criminal gangs of England. During that same day, the 29th of September, a well-dressed gentleman with good manners and a distinguished bearing had been noticed walking to and fro in the cash room where the theft took place. Inquiries had allowed a relatively accurate description of this gentleman to be produced, and it had been immediately sent to every detective in the United Kingdom and beyond. Some optimistic souls, Gautier Ralph amongst them, consequently believed that the thief would find it difficult to escape. But Andrew Stewart was far from sharing his confidence. Accordingly, the discussion continued at the whist table.
"I maintain," said Stewart, "that the odds are in favour of the thief, who is clearly an experienced operator."
"Come on," answered Ralph. "There's not a single country left that he can hide in."
"The world is big enough,"
Stewart persisted.
"It used to be," Fogg said quietly.
"What do you mean, used to be? Has the earth suddenly got smaller?"
"Unquestionably it has."
It was Ralph who responded.
"The earth has shrunk because it can be covered 10 times as quickly now as 100 years ago. In the case we are discussing, this will make the search faster."
"And the thief's escape that much easier."
"Your turn to play, Mr. Stewart," observed Fogg. The doubting Stewart was not convinced, And once the hand was over, he said, "You must admit, Ralph, you have a funny way of saying the earth has shrunk, because you can now go round it in 3 months."
80 days, interjected Fogg.
80 days, confirmed Sullivan. Now they've opened the section of the Great Indian Peninsula Railway from Rotal to Allahabad. This is the calculation done by the Morning Chronicle. London to Suez, by railway and steamship, 7 days. Suez to Bombay, steamship, 13 days. Bombay to Calcutta, railway, 3 days. Calcutta to Hong Kong, steamship, 13 days. Hong Kong to Yokohama, steamship, 6 days. Yokohama to San Francisco, steamship, 22 days. San Francisco to New York, railroad, 7 days. New York to London, steamship and railway, 9 days. Total, 80 days.
Possibly 80 days,
exclaimed Stuart, trumping a winner in his excitement.
But not allowing for unfavourable weather, headwinds, shipwrecks, derailments and so on.
All included, said Fogg.
Even if Red Indians tear up the rails,
cried Stuart. All included, repeated Fogg, laying down his hand. Two winning trumps. Andrew Stuart picked up the cards and started shuffling.
In theory, you may be right, but in practice...
In practice too, Mr. Stuart.
I would gladly wager £4,000, exclaimed Stuart, that such a journey is simply not possible.
On the contrary, perfectly possible, replied Fogg.
We'll do it, then.
All right.
Starting when?
Starting now.
Very well, Mr. Fogg. I'll bet you £4,000 that you fail.
My dear Stuart, said Fallentin.
Steady on, you can't be serious.
When I say I'll bet, answered Stuart, it's always serious.
Fogg turned to his colleagues. I have £20,000 in my account at Baring Brothers. I'll be glad to venture that sum.
£20,000?
Cried Sullivan.
£20,000 that you could lose through an unforeseen mishap?
The unforeseen does not exist.
But, Mr. Fogg, this period of 80 days is merely the minimum it can be done in.
A properly used minimum is enough.
You must be joking.
Like Mr. Stuart, I never joke about anything as important as a bet. I hereby wager £20,000 that I will carry out the tour of the world in 80 days or less. Will you accept the bet? A brief discussion, then...
We accept,
replied Messrs. Stuart, Fallentin, Sullivan, Flanagan and Ralph. Good. The boat train leaves at 8:45. I'll be on it. Phileas Fogg consulted his pocket diary. Since today is Wednesday, the 2nd of October, I must be back in London, here in the drawing room of the Reform Club, at 8:45 p.m. on Saturday, the 21st of December. Failing which, the £20,000 presently deposited in my account at Baring Brothers will belong to you de facto and de jure. Here is a cheque for that amount, gentlemen. At 7:25 p.m, Phileas Fogg, having won a good 20 guineas at whist, said goodbye to his honourable colleagues and left the Reform Club. At 7:50, he opened his front door and went in. Passepartout? The manservant appeared. We're leaving for Calais in 10 minutes. We're going round the world. Passepartout showed all the signs of an astonishment verging on stupefaction.
Around the world?
In 80 days. There is not a moment to lose.
Well, I'll be blowed. And me, who was looking for the quiet life.
By 8 o'clock, Passepartout had prepared a modest bag containing his own and his master's wardrobes. Mr. Fogg was ready. He was carrying under his arm Bradshaw's Continental Railway, Steam Transit, and General Guide. He took the bag from Passepartout, opened it, and dropped in a thick wad of those fine banknotes that are legal tender in all countries. He handed back the bag. "Take care of it. There's £20,000 inside." There was a cab stand at the end of Savile Row. They got into a cab which headed quickly for Charing Cross Station. There Mr. Fogg met his colleagues from the Reform Club. "Gentlemen, I am leaving. The various visas stamped on my passport will allow you to verify my journey when I come back."
"You haven't forgotten when you need to be back?"
inquired Andrew Stewart. "In 80 days, answered Mr. Fogg. "By Saturday, the 21st of December, 1872, at 8:45 p.m. Till we meet again, gentlemen." At exactly 8:45, a whistle sounded and the train pulled out. It had not got past Sydenham before Passepartout emitted a cry of despair. "What's the matter?"
"In my hurry, thinking about other things, I forgot."
"What?"
"To turn off the gas in my bedroom."
"Well, my boy," said Mr. Fogg coldly, "it's burning at your expense." When he left London, Phileas Fogg probably had no idea of the sensation his departure was going to produce. But the news of the wager spread through the Reform Club and generated considerable excitement amongst the members of that august circle. From the club, this agitation spread to the newspapers, and from them to readers in the whole of the United Kingdom. The journey round the world was discussed, commented on, and analysed. Some people supported Phileas Fogg. Others, who soon formed a significant majority, came out against. A trip round the world to be carried out by a deadline using the existing means of transport was not only impossible, it was crazy. Things had reached this point, with Phileas Fogg's supporters getting rarer and rarer, and everybody turning against him. Not without reason. He could be backed at 150 to 1, then 200 to 1. Then, exactly a week after his departure, a completely unexpected development meant that he wasn't backed at all. At 9 p.m. on that day, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police received the following telegram. To Rowan, Commissioner, Scotland Yard, London. Tailing bank robber Phileas Fogg. Send arrest warrant soonest, Bombay, British India. Signed, Fix, Detective Inspector, Suez. The effect of the telegram was considerable. The honourable gentleman vanished, and his place was taken by the thief of the banknotes. Fogg's photograph, available at the Reform Club with those of his colleagues, was duly studied. Every feature appeared identical to those of the description produced by the police inquiries. People remembered how mysterious Phileas Fogg's existence had been, his seclusion, and his sudden departure. And it became evident that this character, inventing a journey around the world and maintaining the pretense with a wager, had had no other aim than to throw the British police off the scent. The telegram had been sent under the following circumstances. On Wednesday, the 9th of October, the liner Mongolia was due to arrive at Suez at 11 o'clock in the morning. The Mongolia plied regularly between Brindisi and Bombay via the Suez Canal. She was one of P&O's quickest ships. While waiting for her arrival, two men were strolling along the quayside. One was the consul of the United Kingdom in Suez. The other was a thin little man with an intelligent face, quick, nervous movements, and constantly knit eyebrows. Through his long lashes shone very bright eyes, which, however, he was able to mask at will. This man was Inspector Fix, one of the policemen who had been sent to various ports after the theft at the Bank of England. Fix was to keep the sharpest lookout on all travellers on the Suez route. 2 days previously, Fix had received the description of the suspected thief from Scotland Yard. This was the distinguished, well-dressed character who had been observed in the cash room of the bank.
"I really can't see how you'll be able to spot your man," said the consul, "even if he is on board."
"People of that sort," replied Fix, "is scent rather than recognise. Flair is everything. It's like a sixth sense, a combination of hearing, sight and smell. Provided that my thief is indeed on board, I can guarantee you that he will not slip through my fingers."
"Do you realise that according to that description, this thief looks exactly like an honest man?"
"With all due respect," answered the inspector, "great thieves always resemble honest men. Honest faces are the ones you've got to take a special look at."
Soon the gigantic hull of the Mongolia came into sight, gliding along between the banks of the canal. 11 o'clock was striking when she dropped anchor. The consul returned to his office, and Fix remained on the quay. There were quite a few passengers on board, most of whom got into the boats which went alongside. Fix examined every one landing with the utmost care. One of the passengers came up to him and asked very politely if Fix could tell him where he would find the British consulate. At the same time, he held out a passport, on which he undoubtedly wished to have a British visa stamped. Fix took the passport and quickly read the description. The document trembled in his hands. The description in the passport was identical to the one he had received from Scotland Yard. He looked at the passenger.
"This isn't your passport."
"No, it's my master's."
"And where is he?"
"Still on board."
"He'll need to go to the consulate in person."
"And where exactly is the consulate?"
"On a corner of the square," replied the inspector, pointing.
The passenger prepared to return to the steamer, and Fix headed for the consulate. He was ushered into the consul's office.
"Sir, I have strong reasons for believing that our man is indeed on board the Mongolia."
And he recounted what had happened.
"Well, Inspector Fix, I would be interested to see the thief's face, but I doubt he'll come to my office if he's the person you think he is. Thieves aren't generally very keen to leave evidence of their movements behind them."
"Sir, if he is as cunning a man as I think, he'll come."
At that moment, the clerk brought in two men, one of them the very servant the detective had spoken to. With him was his master, who presented his passport. The consul examined it, while from a corner of the office Inspector Fix observed, or rather devoured, the stranger.
"Are you Mr. Phileas Fogg?" the consul asked.
"I am."
"Have you just arrived from London?"
"Yes."
"Heading for?"
"Bombay."
"Very good, sir. You know that we no longer require the presentation of passports and that stamping serves no purpose."
"I do, but I wish to use your stamp to prove that I have passed through Suez."
"Very well, sir."
And the consul signed, dated, and stamped the passport. Mr. Fogg paid, raised his hat, and left the office, followed by his servant.
"Well?"
asked the inspector.
"Well, he seems perfectly honest."
"That is hardly the point. Did you not find that this phlegmatic gentleman is a spitting image of the thief whose description I have?"
"Quite possibly. But as you know, all descriptions..."
"I need to be sure," continued Fix. "The servant seems less enigmatic than the master. French, as well. He won't be able to keep his mouth shut. Till we meet again, sir."
Meanwhile, Mr. Fogg had returned to the Mongolia, where he took lunch in his cabin. As for seeing the town, he did not even think of it, being of that breed of Britons who have their servants to do their sightseeing for them. Inspector Fix caught up with Passepartout on the quayside.
"Well, my friend, is your passport now stamped?" "Oh, it's you, sir. Much obliged. Our papers are perfectly in order." "Are you seeing the sights?" "Yes, but we're doing everything so quickly that I seem to be travelling in a dream. I must make sure I don't miss the boat." "You've got plenty of time. It's not yet 12 o'clock.
Passepartout fished out his enormous watch.
12? Come on, it's only 9:52.
"Your watch must be slow."
"It can't be. It's a family heirloom. It never loses more than 5 minutes a year."
"I know what's happened.
You've stayed on London time, which is about 2 hours behind Suez. You need to remember to adjust your watch in each new country.
Me? Touch my watch? Not a chance.
Well, it won't agree with the sun, then.
So much the worse for the sun, sir.
And the honest fellow put the watch back in its fob with a proud gesture.
So you left London in a real hurry?
Fix continued.
I should say so. Last Wednesday, Mr. Fogg came back from the club at 8 in the evening, and we left 3/4 of an hour later.
Where's he going?
Round the world.
Round the world?
Yes, in 80 days. A bet, he says. But just between the two of us, I don't believe a word of it. There must be something else involved.
An eccentric, is he, this Mr. Fogg?
So it would seem.
And wealthy?
Fix asked.
Obviously. He's brought a nice little packet with him in crisp new notes, and he doesn't mind spending it either. He's promised the chief engineer of the Mongolia a handsome reward if we get to Bombay ahead of time.
Have you known your master for long?
For long? I only entered his service on the day we left.
Everything confirmed Fix's preconceptions.
Sir,
he said to the consul at their next meeting,
I've got my man. He's pretending to be an eccentric, trying to do a trip round the world in 80 days. I'm going to send a wire to London telling them to immediately send a warrant for his arrest to Bombay. Then I'll board the Mongolia and tail him as far as India. There, on British soil, I'll politely accost him with the warrant in one hand and the other on his shoulder.
The Mongolia was soon moving so fast as to be ahead of the regulation time. Fix made it his business to renew his acquaintance with Passepartout. He explained his presence on board by claiming that he worked for P&O. Thereafter, he worked assiduously to win the confidence of Mr. Fogg's manservant. As for Mr. Fogg, he played whist. Yes, he had found partners as fanatical as himself. A tax collector heading for Goa, a minister returning to Bombay, and Sir Francis Cromarty, a brigadier general returning to his command at Benares. On Saturday, the 20th of October, at midday, the Indian coast was sighted. 2 hours later, a pilot climbed on board, and at 4:30, the Mongolia drew up alongside Bombay Quay, 2 days ahead of schedule, a fact which Mr. Fogg duly inscribed in the profits column of his schedule. The train to Calcutta was due to leave at 8 p.m. The Mongolia's passengers landed at Bombay at 4:30 p.m. and a Calcutta train was leaving at 8 sharp. Mr. Fogg left the steamer, told his servant exactly what shopping to do, and gave him strict instructions to be at the station by 8 o'clock. Then he headed for the passport office. After having his passport stamped, he went to the station and there ordered dinner. The head waiter ventured to recommend a local rabbit casserole. Mr. Fogg found it detestable. He called the head waiter over.
Garçon, do you call that rabbit?
Yes, my lord. Jungle rabbit.
Are you sure this rabbit didn't meow when it was killed?
Meow? A rabbit? Your Excellency, I swear.
My good man, do not swear. Simply remember this. Indian cats used to be considered sacred animals. That was in the good old days.
For cats, my lord?
For travellers, too. Inspector Fix had rushed off to see the Commissioner of Police in Bombay. He presented his credentials and explained his mission. Had an arrest warrant arrived from London?
Nothing had been received.
Fix was put out. He tried to persuade the Commissioner to give him a warrant for Mr. Fogg's arrest. The Commissioner refused. The case was a matter for the Metropolitan Police, who alone could, by law, issue a warrant. Fix understood that he had to resign himself to waiting. From his conversations with Passepartout, he knew where Fogg was heading and decided to follow him. He requested that, if the arrest warrant arrived from London, it should be forwarded to him in Calcutta, and then headed for the station. Determined to complete the next stage of the journey without allowing his quarry to become aware of his presence. The train left on time. Passepartout was in the same compartment as his master. In the opposite corner sat Sir Francis Cromarty, one of Mr. Fogg's whist partners, from Suez to Bombay. An hour out of Bombay, the train passed over viaducts, crossed Salsette Island, and reached the mainland. After Pauli Station, it headed off into the Western Ghats, ranges whose highest summits are covered in thick forests. During the night, the train crossed the Ghats, and the following day, the 21st of October, dashed across the state of Khandesh, then crossed the gloomy region so often drenched in blood by the disciples of the goddess Kali. At 7 the following morning, Passepartout consulted his watch in response to a question from Sir Francis Cromarty and replied that it was 3 in the morning. And indeed, this wonderful watch of his was, quite logically, 4 hours slow, being set to the Greenwich Meridian, nearly 77 degrees further west. Sir Francis tried to make him realize that he had to adjust to each new meridian. Since he was constantly travelling eastwards, towards the sun, each time a degree was covered, the day lost 4 minutes. It was no use. Whether or not the stubborn fellow understood, he obstinately refused to put his watch forward. At 8 a.m. the train stopped in the middle of a vast jungle clearing, bordered by a few bungalows and workers' huts. The guard walked along the track, shouting, "All change! All change!" Phileas Fogg looked at Sir Francis, who seemed nonplussed by this halt. Passepartout dashed out onto the track and came back almost immediately, exclaiming, "Sir, no railway!" The Brigadier General immediately left the carriage. Phileas Fogg followed him. The two men approached the guard.
"Where are we?"
asked Sir Francis.
"At the village of Colby."
"Are we stopping here?"
"We have to. The railway isn't finished yet."
"What? Not finished?"
"No. There is still 50 miles to be completed between here and Allahabad, where the tracks start up again."
"But the newspapers said the railway was open right through."
"The newspapers were wrong."
Sir Francis was beginning to boil.
"But you sold us tickets from Bombay to Calcutta."
"Yes, but most passengers are well aware that they have to get themselves from Colby to Allahabad."
"Sir Francis," said Mr. Fogg, "we shall have to consider, with your help, how to get to Allahabad."
"Mr. Fogg, this delay has completely ruined your expedition."
"No, Sir Francis, my plans anticipated..."
"What? You knew that the track..."
"Not at all. But I knew that some sort of obstacle would appear sooner or later. There is no harm done. I have 2 days in hand, thanks to the speed with which the Mongolia reached Bombay. The steamer leaves Calcutta for Hong Kong at midday on the 25th. Today is only the 22nd, so we may yet arrive in Calcutta on time." It was only too true that most travellers knew about the break in the track, and Inspector Fix had acquired the information at an early stage in the journey. He was among the first of those who had left the train, commandeered all the various vehicles available at Colby, and continued on their way. Accordingly, although they searched the village high and low, Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis returned empty-handed. At this moment, Passepartout appeared.
"Sir, I think I've found the means of transport."
"What is it?"
"An elephant."
He led his master and Sir Francis to a hut adjoining an enclosure. In the hut was an Indian. In the enclosure, an elephant. Kiuni, for this was his name, was, like the rest of his species, able to move quickly for long periods. Since he lacked any other transportation, Mr. Fogg asked the Indian if he wanted to sell his elephant. The Indian refused, point blank. Phileas Fogg offered him £1,000. The Indian rejected the deal. Mr. Fogg offered £1,200, then £1,500, then £1,800. At £2,000, the Indian gave in. Mr. Fogg paid him in banknotes from his famous bag. It only remained to find a guide. This proved easier. A bright-looking Parsi offered his services. Mr. Fogg accepted and promised him a high rate of pay, which could only increase his intelligence. The Parsi was experienced in the profession of mahout, or elephant keeper. He covered the elephant's back with a saddle cloth and arranged a howdah, or litter, on each side of its body. Mr. Fogg then offered Sir Francis a ride to Allahabad station. Food and drink were bought in the village. Sir Francis took his seat in one of the litters and Mr. Fogg in the other. Passepartout sat astride the saddle cloth between the two of them, and the Parsi perched himself on the elephant's neck. At 9 o'clock, the animal left the village and thrust its way into the forest. Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis, buried up to their necks in the litters, were shaken around by its stiff trot. They endured the situation with the most British imperturbability. As for Passepartout, he received the full force of every jolt. He was thrown back and forth between the neck and rump of the elephant. But he joked and laughed, and from time to time pulled a sugar lump out of his bag that the intelligent Kiuni took with the end of his trunk, without for a moment interrupting his regular trot. At 8 p.m., the travellers halted in front of a ruined bungalow. The night was cold, so the Parsi lit a fire. Dinner consisted of the food bought at Colby, which the travellers ate in a worn-out and black-and-blue state. Conversation began with a few disjointed sentences, but soon finished up with loud snores. The guide stood watch near Kiuni, who slept standing up, leaning against the trunk of a big tree. At 6 a.m. the march was resumed. At about midday, Allahabad station was only 12 miles northeast. A halt was made beneath a clump of banana trees. At 2 o'clock, the guide headed into the cover of a dense forest, through which they were going to travel for several miles. Nothing untoward had happened so far, and the journey seemed about to finish without incident, when the elephant suddenly stopped dead, showing signs of uneasiness.
"What's the matter?"
asked Sir Francis.
"I don't know, esteemed sir," replied the Parsi,
tuning his ears to a confused murmur coming out of the dense foliage. Moments later, the murmur became more distinct. It might have been a concert of human voices and brass instruments, although still a long way off. The Parsi jumped down, tied the elephant to a tree, and worked his way under the thickest undergrowth. Minutes later, he was back.
"A procession of Brahmins heading our way. We should try to keep out of sight."
He untied the elephant and led it into a copse, requesting the travellers not to get down. He himself stood ready to mount quickly if flight seemed necessary. The noise was coming closer. Chanting mingled with the sounds of drums and cymbals. Soon the head of the procession appeared under the trees, about 50 yards away. In the first line were priests in long embroidered robes, wearing mitres. They were surrounded by men, women, and children chanting a sort of dirge, interrupted at regular intervals by the sounds of tam-tams and cymbals. Behind them came a carriage drawn by 2 pairs of richly caparisoned zebus. The spokes of the vast wheels were shaped like interlaced snakes. On the carriage was a hideous statue. It had 4 arms. The body was deep red, the eyes wild, the hair tousled, the tongue lolling, the lips coloured with henna and betel. Around its neck was draped a garland of death's heads, and on its waist a girdle of severed hands. The figure was standing over a prostrate giant whose head was missing.
"Kali," Sir Francis murmured, "the goddess of love and death."
Behind the statue, a group of Brahmins were dragging a young woman hardly able to stand. Her head, neck, shoulders, ears, arms, fingers and toes were laden with jewelled necklaces, bracelets, earrings and rings. A tunic of gold lame, covered with thin muslin, revealed the curves of her waist. Behind her, guards armed with sabres and pistols were carrying a corpse on a palanquin. This was the body of an old man, dressed in the rich raiment of a Raja.
He wore a turban embroidered with pearls, robes of silk and gold, a belt of diamond-studded cashmere, and the magnificent weapons of a prince. Musicians and a rear guard of fanatics, their cries sometimes drowning the deafening crash of the instruments, closed the cortege. Sir Francis turned to the guide.
"A sooty!"
he exclaimed. The Parsi nodded. The long procession slowly wound its way through the trees and disappeared into the depths of the forest.
"A sooty?" Phileas Fogg asked the Brigadier General.
"A sooty is a human sacrifice. The woman you've just seen will be burned at daybreak."
"Oh, the bastards!"
cried Passepartout. "And the body?" inquired Mr. Fogg.
"The prince, her husband," answered the guide. "One of the independent rajas of Bundelkhand."
"Can it be," said Phileas Fogg, "that these barbaric customs survive in India?"
"The poor woman,"
murmured Passepartout,
"burned alive."
"Sometimes," the Brigadier General observed, "the sacrifice is voluntary."
The guide shook his head.
"The sacrifice to take place at dawn tomorrow is not a voluntary one."
"How do you know?"
"It's a story everyone in Bundelkhand knows."
"But the poor woman didn't seem to be offering any resistance,"
said Sir Francis.
"That is because she is drugged with opium and hashish fumes."
"Where are they taking her?"
"Pelagi Pagoda, 2 miles from here. She'll spend the night there until the sacrifice."
"Which will happen?"
"At first light."
Mr. Fogg turned to Sir Francis. "What about saving this woman?"
"Saving her, Mr. Fogg?"
"I'm still 12 hours ahead of my timetable. This could be a way of putting them to good use."
"I say, you do have a heart."
"Yes, when I have the time."